the king and queen of your castle. You are the king and queen. I always tell my student wives, don't call between 9 and 5 unless afterwards call if it's an emergency, because the king comes home to the queen and we pull up the drawbridge and we are in our castle. Now, I know you've got princes and princesses and they can get in the way. But you also tell them there is a time when the king and queen have to go into conference and into a clique, and that's our time. And when you go home as king and queen and Mr. and Mrs. Wonderful, remember to act that way and to treat each other with great respect. I say whenever I've been to every group I've spoken to, remember that we're all going to return to dust. You're on loan. And in this room, one of us is the next person to die. One of us. And I know it's going to be me because I've said it so many times now in so many groups that it's got to be me. But one of us. So have another look at your spouse. They are of great value and great worth. They're on loan. What can you do to make their life more comfortable? Respect them. I respect Arch as much as I respect you. Many of us respect each other, but we don't respect our spouse. And I pray after this weekend you'll have the Lord, you'll allow the Lord to help you to renew, to change the respect for your spouse, so that if they are caught up suddenly to meet with the Lord, you'll have no regrets. When Richard died, I had my date with him. I had a date with him every month. I had my date with him the week before. And we had reason to dislike Richard immensely. We really did. But I loved him. You see, I told you yesterday, the one sentence, I learned to act and not react. And the two of you, now you're going back, learn to act toward each other. And how should you act? Colossians 3:12-15. As God's chosen people. And we had communion this morning. And we were chosen. He loved us before we loved him. You are chosen people. You are called to minister, to bring healing, the good news to others. As God's chosen people, holy and dearly loved, clothe yourselves with compassion, kindness, humility, gentleness, and patience. Bear with your spouse and your family. This is how you've got to act. With compassion, kindness, gentleness, humility, and patience. And you must bear with one another. And in marriage, you have to bear with each other. Because we're imperfect people and we've got our quirks. What's new? And then it goes on to say, and forgive what grievances you may have against your spouse or your children. There's the answer. Forgive. The Lord forgave us this morning afresh of what our failings. Now, we're going to go into our homes and we've got to forgive each other for being imperfect, for failing. And you'll have to forgive each other every day for the rest of your lives. So go and renew that. And forgive as the Lord forgave you this morning. And let the peace of God rule in your hearts. And that the peace of God will. Now you're going to go back to your home and I want to say, stay with Jesus. In your home. You're going back into your ministry. Stay with Jesus. You're going to need him. He's got the power. He has the life flow. And he will flow through you in mighty power as you stay with him. Remember, you are a branch. He is the vine. And remember 1 Peter 5:2. You are an example. So you have to stay close to Jesus. You have to receive that life flow from the vine. Otherwise, you're not going to be a good example. And then, the sentence, let Jesus hold you. Oh, be still. Let your soul rest in the Lord. And let him hold you close. Because that's the safest place to be. And the most powerful place. You see, when you let Jesus hold you, he breathes the Holy Spirit into you. And that's where the power comes. Now, my prayer for you, as I leave you, dear precious ones, precious children of God, sheep of the great shepherd, those of you who have been called, may you continue to love God with all your heart. May you continue to obey Him. May you listen to hear what His orders and His will is as you lay quietly in His arms. May you continue to bring glory to Him, and may you please Him in all you do and say. We love you. The Lord hold you close in His arms. Be still. Amen.
Turn with me to 2 Corinthians chapter 4. 2 Corinthians chapter 4. And for the time we have this morning, I want to talk about burnout. And the Apostle Paul has something to say about it. It's just amazing. I have enjoyed being with you folk. It's good to be with Baptists who believe the Bible, who trust the Word, who value the blood. Thank you for that this morning. That song, that hymn we sang, I don't know, you didn't know that. It's my favorite hymn, Jesus. Jesus, keep me near the cross. They're a precious fountain, filled with blood. And it's wonderful to be with people who believe that. And it's been very precious. But I want to talk about burnout this morning, and the Apostle Paul has something to say about it. In this chapter 4, remember, we're talking these first six chapters, Paul's theology of ministry. And then chapter 4 is the stress chapter, but he begins the chapter by saying, therefore, since through God's mercy we have this ministry, we do not lose heart. Therefore, the portion before had to do with the Shekinah glory. But Moses had to cover his face because it was waning. And what Paul is saying, that in the New Covenant, the glory doesn't fade. It's the exact reverse. The glory shines more and more and more and more and more. Therefore, that's the connection. That's the therefore connection. This glory is not fading. We don't have to hide our faces. We can be bold. And Paul talks about being bold all the time. Being bold, be bold. Be bold and we can show our faces because it's full of glory. Therefore, since we have this ministry, through God's mercy, we do not lose heart. That phrase, we do not lose heart, is what I'm on about this morning. We do not. It appears about 7 or 8 times in Scripture. Do not lose heart. It's more of an English expression. It means several things. Paul, near the end of the chapter, verse 16, if you look, he says, therefore, we do not lose heart. Therefore, we do not lose heart. Though outwardly we are wasting away, yet inwardly we are being renewed day by day. For our light and momentary troubles are achieving for us an eternal glory, for that far outweighs them all. So we fix our eyes not on that which is seen, but what is unseen. For what is seen is temporary, but what is unseen is eternal. Therefore, we do not lose heart. I have a friend, known him for, 40 years, 45 years, by the name of Ted Engstrom. You may have heard his name, co-founded Youth for Christ with Billy Graham, one of Billy's closest friends. And I've known him a long time. He came to South Africa when I was in Youth for Christ and we put on big rallies. I remember a big stadium in Johannesburg and we put Ted, his little portly, but we put him on the back of a truck. We drove him around the stadium with a loudspeaker while he preached. And years later, when I helped found the organization now known as African Enterprise, Ted became one of our board members in the United States. And when we came to the United States, I went on the board. And Ted and I have been close friends ever since. He and I alternate as chairman of the board. Wonderful man. Great preacher. But Ted Engstrom does not believe a Christian can burn out. So I sit and debate this with Ted. I say, Ted, listen to me. You don't ever burn out. But you are what Spurgeon refers to in that portion from his lectures to his students that I read yesterday. You are one of these men of steel. Nothing rusts. You're stainless steel. You're silver steel. You don't rust. But what about us ordinary men and women? So while I understand why Ted says, if you're a believer, if you're a Christian, you don't burn out. While I understand that, I think he's speaking out of his own experience. Phenomenal experience. There are people who are super people, supermen, superwomen. I'm not one of them. Some years ago, I had in therapy with me a couple, and what brings it to mind is all the news about your Australian who's in the Endeavour right now, astronaut. But I worked with an astronaut and his wife, one of the men who went to the moon. It was an interesting experience. Superman. Man of steel. PhD in aeronautical engineering, a top notch. One of the top fighter pilots in the Navy of the United States. And in the early days of the astronaut program, they didn't take ordinary men. You had to be extraordinary. They're not going to put you on top of a billion-dollar rocket, shoot you into space, some of the first men to do that, when you're going to panic, get all scared and shivery and stuff like that. Now, this man was a superman. I mean, it was an extraordinary person. He happened to make a horrible, terrible husband, because supermen don't make good husbands. But an extraordinary person. He's on the other side of the moon as commander of the module when it started to tumble. Left side of the moon, the earth, no contact with the earth, all the dark side of the moon by himself, tumbling in space. I said, weren't you scared? Scared? No. I had things to do. And he's right, you know. In the manual there's a section. What to do when the capsule tumbles in space? You turn to that. Press button one. Flick that switch on. Do this, do the other. Phenomenal. Now, I'm making the point that there may be a few among us who will never, ever suffer from burnout. We are either superhuman or stupid. One or the other. If you have a heart, if you feel, if you in any way are ordinary, then burnout is a risk. Losing heart is what burnout is all about. I talked last night about stress. Stress can kill you. Burnout will not kill you. That's the good news. The bad news is you will wish you were dead. It is a phenomenon. It's a phenomenon of very recent origin. Comes to us out of the 60s. A man by the name of Freudenberger was the person who first coined the phrase. And he coined the phrase after having worked with drug addicts. He noticed that counselors and workers with recovering drug addicts went through a very unique response. They started out real caring and loving and concerned. But after a period of time, they lost their passion. They become uncaring. They weren't concerned anymore. And so Freudenberger coined the phrase that they were burnt out. The images of a truck or a car you occasionally come across when you're driving on the open highway, out in the felt to the side, broken down, someone's put a match to it, burnt out. It's a concept that applies only to people helpers. truck drivers don't burn out. They crash. They get ulcers, they get a lot of stress, but they don't burn out. Burnout is a people helping phenomenon. And that makes it an interesting one right there. Why is it that only those who are relating to people are the ones who experience it? But the fact is, and by the way, there is an outline. I hope that you have found it. But the fact is that burnout is a phenomenon that strikes only those who are people helpers. Now let me give you a definition so we can be clear about what we're saying. Burnout is a syndrome of emotional exhaustion. Let me pause there for a moment. It's emotional exhaustion. Stress is adrenaline exhaustion, overuse of the adrenal system. Burnout is an overuse of the emotions and the emotional exhaustion that follows that. It's emotional exhaustion and reduced personal accomplishment that occurs in people who do in individuals who do people work. Reduced personal accomplishment. There is one phrase I think that sums it up beautifully and totally. And it's the phrase demoralized. Demoralized. That's what burnout is. Who doesn't burn out? People who don't care. People who have no passion, they don't burn out. So you've got to light the fire before you can let it burn out. No fire, no burnout. And all lots of pastors, never going to burn out. Because they're not on fire. They don't really care. Ministry is just a job. I start at 9 o'clock, quit 3 o'clock in the afternoon. No one really knows where I am. You know. Got a few hobbies and maybe a little business on the side or something like that. Last minute I throw a few things together for a sermon. I know clergy like that. I know pastors like that. I know what denominations they're in too. They're not in the Baptist denomination usually. But they don't burn out. But what is also interesting about stress versus burnout is that stress tends to predominate in type A personalities, but burnout tends to predominate in type B personalities. Now that's a generalization, and obviously a lot of stress can predispose you to burnout. When stress is getting at you, you lose your capacity to cope, your emotions get out of control, you experience emotional exhaustion, and burnout is the result. Type B people have the edge. They've already got a head start over the type A. The type A person runs away from things a lot. You know, when things get hard going, well, just start something new. Just get another adrenaline fix going. And only when that gets exhausted, then now they move over into the track for burnout. But by and large, type Bs have a head start in burnout. Some research we have done shows that Type B people are already significantly burnt out because for several reasons. One of them is that Type B people tend to feel things more deeply than Type A's. Type A's can shrug things off, you know. Type B's don't do it so easily, not as easily. So while they don't rush around and get all that addiction stuff going, when something doesn't work out and so on, they tend to hold it in. And so their emotions tend to go a little bit more teeter-totter. Type A is just not paying attention to their emotions. They're blind. So type B, and I'm generalizing there, you know, there are a lot of type Bs who can handle their emotions and so forth, but there's one characteristic that beyond that fact that type Bs feel things more deeply, there's another characteristic of the type B person that is a real problem in the area of burnout, and that is type B people tend not to share themselves as openly as type A's. Type A's can give vent to stuff. So they explode and they get angry and so forth. Type B's tend not to share. And our research has shown that it's this inability to share that is the real risk factor in burnout. Type A or type B? Not having a good support group. Not having someone you can unburden things with. When you have to carry a burdensome responsibility and you can't ever share it with anyone, that's when burnout occurs. I have a burnt out twice in my life, very significantly. The one was just before I left South Africa. Totally burnt out. The only Christian psychologist in a radius of 400 miles, 500 miles. When I saw a patient, they would drive all day, night. And I can't just see them for 1 hour and send them home. And so often it would be 3 or 4 hours late into the night working with people. And I'd built a consulting room onto my home and it was just too much. It's not overwork. Overwork does not burn you out. It's carrying the burden of it and not having anyone you can share it with. Being isolation, cut off. That's why the pastor of a small congregation out in the boondocks, not having good support, not having, you know, buddies he or she can go and talk to occasionally, that's the person at high risk for burnout. I never see burnout in senior pastors of large congregations. Never see burnout. But the second time happened when I was dean and our first provost died, Glenn Barker. I talked about him. And our president, about for a year and a half, we didn't have a provost. So I didn't have anyone I was accountable to. And they've hubbard the president. Oh, he's so busy. I mean, why bother him? I can make decisions. I don't need anyone else to tell me what to do. I'm a self-motivator. I can handle the crises. And so I say to David, no, I got no problems this month. David, let's just skip our meeting. You've got other stuff to do. And what happened was that a false sense of my own strength set me up to think that I could handle everything. And after about 6 months, this deep depression came down upon me. And that's one of the signs of burnout. One gets depressed. You become demoralized. And demoralization is a form of depression. It's the loss of passion. And I sat up one night in the middle of the night, couldn't get to sleep, and realized I'd made a fundamental mistake in thinking I could do it by myself. And the next morning, I called David Hubbard. I said, Dave, I need to meet with you. I need to meet with you regularly. I don't care how busy you are. I need to meet with you. Sure, sure, he said. Sat down with him. Now, you see, and I said, David, I don't need your advice on any decisions. I don't need your advice. But I need to be accountable to you for the decisions I have made. It's an accountability issue. And within a week or two, I could feel the burnout lifting and my morale lifted again and the passion came back and, you know, the excitement was there again. We need to be accountable. It's not that in the accountability we need wisdom. I don't need advice. I don't need advice. I need a listening ear. And if you listen, then I can talk, then I can listen to myself, and I'm probably the best judge of whether what I'm doing is right or wrong. So as I talk, I get the insight. Now, what does burnout? I've got a list there. I don't have time to talk about them. Determined idealists. People with high expectations. The higher your mountain of expectations, the deeper is the valley of disappointment going to be, unless you pay attention to what you're doing. People are overcommitted. The overdedicated. Overly sympathetic. I'm going to say a little bit more about that later, but when you're overly sympathetic, when your emotions resonate too much with other people's emotions, risk of burnout. Type B personalities, they feel more intensely. They don't use support systems. They're very private people. Not necessarily introverted, but some type Bs are in fact introverted, so they don't share. They're more easily demoralized. They don't have the energy to escape. Type A people can run away quicker and more easily than anyone else. And so they by and large escape it. Now, what are some of the characteristics? I'm going to separate into two categories. There are two types of burnout that we need to be aware of in ministry. The first type of burnout is acute burnout. That's crisis burnout. And the other is chronic burnout. Just separate for you in your mind those two. Let me talk about acute burnout. In acute burnout, something happens. Suddenly, someone kicks the support base out from under you. Suddenly, there's a crisis. Suddenly, everyone's abandoning the ship. Suddenly, the deacons are against you, or a deacon is against you. And so suddenly your support base is pulled out. So acute burnout is situationally determined. Sudden in onset, I've got the characteristics there. There is an accelerated decline, almost the spiral I talked about when I described the flying experience, the aerobatic experience, where you put it into a spin. That the feel in acute burnout is, I've lost control. I'm looking down at the ground, and all I see is everything spinning around me. There are situational conflicts. Acute illness can sometimes precipitate an acute burnout. Acute depression, sudden onset of depression, can precipitate it. But always there's this profound feeling of helplessness. Nothing I can do, makes any difference. Helplessness, I mentioned yesterday, is an interesting phenomenon. One experiment in which this phenomenon is described by Seligman and some of his cohorts. You take a bunch of students. Now, most psychological research is either done on rats or students. In this particular experiment, you take students, college students, not seminary students, regular college students. Usually introduction psychology class are guinea pigs a lot. You take a group of students, and you put them in a room. This room only has four walls, four painted walls, no lights, no fixtures. It's just naturally lit. On the wall is a single switch. And the students are asked to sit around the table and just stay there. No matter what happens, just to stay in the room. Suddenly a loud, piercing sound fills the air. Uncomfortably loud. Students panic, they look around. One student notices a switch on the wall, goes to the switch and flicks it up and down, but nothing happens. The sound is loud, uncomfortable. Finally, the students settle down and sit and passively just accept the sound. And finally, it stops. Now, the next day, you take that same group of students and you take them to a different room, but it's set up exactly the same, but a slightly different location. They're told, just sit around the table and do nothing. Just wait. Just wait. Just stay in the room. Not sit around the table, but stay in the room. They sit there, and suddenly this loud, piercing sound comes on again. And they look around, and they figure, and they notice the switch on the wall. And not one of them, this experiment has been done many times, not one of them gets up to go and see if the switch does anything. Because this time, the switch turns off the sound. It turns off the sound. But nobody, they don't leave their chair. And this is what is known as learnt helplessness. It didn't work the first time, so it's not going to work the second time. It didn't work in the last church, so what's the point of trying it now? It's not going to work this time. It explains why many people go back to unpleasant, almost violent situations. Wives who go back to abusive husbands. Every time. This learned helplessness concept is what's used to explain that. The wife comes to believe there is nothing she can do to change anything. It's learned helplessness. Now I want to suggest to you, pastors and spouses, that learned helplessness is very common in ministry. Often you're in situations where, you know, you get in the car and you drive and this time the steering wheel works, and the next time you get in, you turn the steering wheel, it doesn't work. And if it doesn't work often enough, you get to the point where you'll not try the third time to see if it still works, you see. And so helplessness leads to burnout, and this acute burnout is often the consequence. I want to describe chronic burnout, D, and then come back to talk about how we deal with it. Characteristics of chronic burnout. Chronic burnout is not sudden in onset. It is insidious, slow. It's the gradual erosion of your confidence. Every day there is something that demoralizes you, just a little bit, so imperceptibly that you don't see the accumulated effect of that. Yes, please ask questions. Yes, absolutely, absolutely. Thank you. That's a good phrase. I'm glad for those. So make sure you ask questions. Thank you. Yes, you become cynical. Ah, doesn't make any difference. Whatever I do, they're not going to listen. But in the chronic, it is very slow. It happens so slowly. Now, our research shows this, that one in five pastors within 5 years of leaving seminary or college, one in five are burnt out by the fifth year, are showing advanced signs of burnout. So all it takes in ministry, 5 years to burn out, one in five. At the tenth year, it is 3 out of 5 showing signs of burnout. This is a slow erosion of your confidence. Slow erosion of your hope. You started out with such high hope, full of ambition, dream, and slow. It's been eaten away. Just ever so gradually. So you don't notice it coming along. You just don't notice it as it develops. And the characteristics then of chronic burnout, it's insidious. Often type B personality is present. There are many plateaus, so I'm not suggesting that it's all gradual downwards. It starts to go down, then it seems to level off for a little bit. And you sort of think, it's going to be okay. And then it starts to fall again, and then levels off. Might even pick up a little bit, and then it starts to fall down again. So it's very ups and downs. There are often ongoing minor conflicts, just little things. Success-failure ratio is low. In other words, you fail more often than you succeed at things. You lose more often than you win. There is a decline in the support system. The support system may be good and strong at first, and slowly people begin to pull back. Slowly there isn't the support. There's a low-grade depression. Low-grade means that you hardly even notice it, but it's so hard getting out of the bed in the morning. One of the signs of burnout for me that I look out for is my reaction to the telephone. When I left South Africa to go to the United States, I had so come to fear the telephone that when it rang, I nearly jumped out of my skin. I had a massive reaction, conditioned response to a telephone bell ringing. It's just phenomenal, particularly the type of bell we have in South Africa. And whenever it rang, my body would freeze. I could feel the chill go up and down my spine. Because it's another person with a problem. I can't give anymore. Don't you understand? I don't have another ounce to give to anyone. And then the phone rings. And you wonder, how much longer can I take this? I had this profound fear of the telephone. Now, ever since then, I have hated the telephone. It's high on my hate list. Telephones are satanic inventions. Satan invented the telephone. I'm telling you. I use answer machines. Have a secretary. I do not answer the telephone. You can call me until you're blue in the face. I will never answer a telephone. My wife answers the telephone. My secretary. Or answer machine. But I have never, that's 25 years ago, and I have never gotten over my intense reaction to the telephone. Oh, well, the other reasons I don't answer the telephone, and primarily because it's so time-consuming. My secretary says, write a letter. You get a quicker response if you write a letter. I think that the telephone is an intrusive device, and most of us are imprisoned to our telephones. Why do you have to answer the phone? You know, you go into a shop, don't you? Type A personalities, you go to a store, and the person is serving you, and the telephone rings. What do? They stop, they say, excuse me, and they give priority to the telephone. What law gives the telephone priority over your presence? I get furious. My blood boils, my adrenaline just, you know. I used to, now these days I try to control it. But you know what I mean. And the telephone is, the reaction to the telephone is a pretty good sign. Chronic illness often is a sign of chronic burnout. Slow, insidious burnout. Because your immune system now is becoming compromised, and so your immune system can't fight off illness, and then you go into a chronic illness mode. Always got the flu, always got a sore throat, always sick. It's an immune system problem. And the other thing about chronic burnout is that it eludes recognition. You don't recognize it so easily. The acute burnout is so sudden, and the change in your mood is so dramatic that it's easy to recognize it. The chronic burnout, it happens so slowly, you don't see it, you don't notice it. And so maybe you sit and talk to somebody who knows a little bit about it, and then you begin to do some self-discovery, and you realize, my word, you know, I don't have the fire anymore. I don't feel what I used to feel for people. In fact, I want to avoid them. If there's a crisis or a problem, I want to run away. Now, let's go back now to look at what we do for... I want to cover two aspects briefly, namely recovery and then prevention. But in many respects, recovery and prevention are the same. Whatever you have to do to prevent burnout is what you've got to do to recover from burnout. So immediately you're aware of burnout, you've got to start moving to recovery mode. You've got to do both. Now, coping with acute burnout, point number two, you've got to stop the slide. In acute burnout, it seems like you've been walking close to the edge, and if you ever happened to you, you're walking close to the edge and suddenly the ground gives way under you and you start to fall. Now, just imagine a fairly steep slope from that point down. Now, acute burnout is the foundation has slipped out from under you and you're starting to slide down. The best mental image I can give you in acute burnout is stop the slide. Take control of your learned helplessness and grasp at anything that will stop you slipping any further. And it's amazing what little things can help. One pastor I worked with once, in advanced stage of burnout. When burnout is advanced, what happens is that your field of vision narrows until you become preoccupied with the petty. This pastor found himself, he had his office at the back of the church, second upstairs. And the back of the church was a large parking area, and the parking area was next to a supermarket that didn't have enough parking. So that often what would happen during peak periods, that people going to the supermarket couldn't find parking in the supermarket, so they'd sneak into the church parking lot that was empty. Park there. As this pastor became more and more burnt out, he noticed that he would sit at his desk for long hours, staring out of the window, keeping an eye on the parking lot. waiting for someone to park there who shouldn't be parking there, and then rushing downstairs to go and challenge the person. No, this is a church parking lot. Mustn't park here. Get out. That was the only level of functioning he had left. Preoccupied with the petty. Focusing down. We refer to it as making a fetish of little things. And so you've got to stop the slide. And anything that will do it. I can't prepare a sermon. Well then, can you go back to a previous sermon and pull it out and just freshen it up a little bit? Yes, I suppose I can do that. See, any little thing, you've got to take control. In acute burnout, anything that will stop the slide, anything, and stop the slide, and then you've got to dig in. You've got to take control, avoid helplessness, consolidate. Pull back and regroup. To use a military metaphor, the battle is turning against you. What do? You pull back to a retreat line and you try to consolidate at that point. You don't turn and run. You pull back to buy a little space, dig in, and consolidate. The third point that I have down there is that you learn to take advantage of the crisis. Sometimes, and this is the point I want to make about acute burnout, sometimes burnout is God's plan for your life. Sometimes it is God's plan. Sometimes this is the only way God can bring you up and say, do you know, this is not what I want you to be doing. This is not where I want you to be ministering. How else can I get your attention? I've put the obstacles. I've put the roadblocks up to get your attention. And so you have to take advantage of the crisis. In every acute burnout, you've got to pull back and say, now what does God have in mind for me here? And then with a sense of awe and openness, be willing for something new to happen in your life. This is growth opportunity. Failures are to grow by, and if failure is the cause of this acute burnout, then there's something to learn here. Be open to receive something. Fourthly, maximize your opportunities. Consider further preparation. This is why I'm such a strong advocate for our Doctor of Ministry program. I don't need to be, it's not part of my school. But I just know that perhaps one of the most critical things in preventing burnout and certainly in helping a person recover from it is that you've got to take that person back up to the mountaintop and to be able to look down. I just loved it when Jeff drove us up, getting higher and higher. We stopped for a moment at the scenic point and we looked back down the valley. We were down in there in Calundra, you say? First few days, it was real miserable weather, wind was blowing, you know. But my, when you get up to the mountain and you look back on that, it was glorious. Absolutely glorious. Now the trouble is, you see, burnout is a worm's eye view. It's a worm's eye view. And so you've got to pull back up. And one of the things that continuing education does for you, it helps you climb up the mountain a little bit. Look at the panorama of things. Look at things from God's perspective. Get the bird's eye view. Get that eagle's eye view. Maximize your opportunities. Consider further preparation. Consider faceting. I don't have time to explain it, but that is basically by faceting. Faceting is what we do when we polish diamonds. I mentioned that I was fascinated with gold. I'm even more fascinated with diamonds. Born in Kimberley, South Africa, well, the diamond. My grandfather was the operator that for the winding winch that raised and lowered men down into the mine. And so as a little 3 or 4 year old, I remember working with my grandfather, holding my hand, and we would walk in the felt around Kimberley, and he would say to me, pulling my leg, of course, but I didn't know that. He says, Archie, diamonds are everywhere. You've got to keep your eyes. I said, Grandpa, how will you know if it's a diamond? He says, it just looks like a plain bit of old glass. Every now, at my age, when I see a little piece of a broken bottle or something like that on the ground, I say, is it a diamond, I wonder? And I pick it up and I examine it and I scratch it, you know, it's glass. It could be sapphire. But then since my family is in the diamond business, some polishing and so forth, I became fascinated with what you do to a dull piece of glass like a raw diamond. What gives it its brilliance is faceting. You polish faces on it. And so I once built myself a faceting machine. Built the whole thing myself, and I get little ugly pieces of colored, looks like colored glass, amethyst, or never been able to get my hands on a raw diamond. I mean, I'm waiting. And then you just start with some diamond dust, you put it on the wheel, and you start the polishing process. It's all calibrated and so on. And then it's gorgeous. It's just beautiful. Now, the problem with clergy is this. This is my point, that most clergy are not very well faceted. Maybe you've got one face. So I talk about one-eyed monster. You've got one eye that you look out on the world. You see everything only through that one eye. Got no hobbies. There is not enough time in one life for me to do everything I want to do, folks. Right? You know, I want to know everything. I want to know about astronomy. I want to be able to watercolor paint. Yeah, there's so much I want to know. I want to know philosophy. It's just on and on and on. Faceting is creating appetites for things. That's what faceting is. And faceting is, imagine this hall with no windows. That's non-faceted. Now put a window in on one side. You let some light in. You pull back. Pastors are notoriously lacking in faceting. And that also makes you dull in conversation and preaching, because, you know, I some of the most brilliant preachers I know read voraciously. They're always taking in things. But faceting helps in the burnout process, because that's what helps you to get up onto the mountaintop and begin to see the panorama of things. Buy time, don't rush your options. This is, you've got to watch this. It's very easy in an acute burnout to say, I'm going to split. I'm going to run away. I'm going to resign. No. Consolidate, hold on, dig in, buy time. Don't rush your options. Don't react, as Kath always says, don't react. Act. Fifthly, deal with your irrational beliefs and feelings. A lot of burnout is caused by irrational thinking. And let me tell you the story. Came to my office one day early in the morning. Had a morning when I was going to see patients. Invited the first person to come in, 8 o'clock in the morning. And I looked over to the corner, and there was a gentleman sitting. I greeted him. I went in, spent the hour with my patient, came out. Invited the next patient to come in, and I looked, and the gentleman was still sitting there. I thought, this is strange. He's been sitting there all this time. Well, maybe he's waiting for somebody. Went in. Third time I came out, he was still sitting there. So I said to my client, go into my office. I just want to have a word with this gentleman. I walked up to him, and I said, excuse me, I'm Dr. Hart, but can I help you? He looked up, and he said, yes. He said, I'm waiting to see you. So I looked at my client, I said, do we have an appointment? No, but I want to see you. He said, my wife said to me this morning, you go to Dr. Hart's waiting room and you sit there until he notices you, and you don't come home until you've seen Dr. Hart. So I'm just sitting here waiting. He looked depressed. You can see depression in the eyes, deeply depressed. And obviously in distress. So I said to him, oh, well, okay, I just have this one client, then I'm free for an hour. You just wait and I'll see you. Then at the end of the hour, I invited him to come in and sat down. Turns out, he's a pastor, 39 years of age. He and his wife is a pastor. They are in co-ministry together. They'd come from Texas about 6 or 7 years before, to take this particular church because it showed so much promise. The church leadership had offered so much, and he had great dreams for this church. And here he was now 39 years, 11 months. It's true. 39 years and 11 months old. Birthday just 1 month away. He's gone into a deep depression, he says. And he's gone into a deep depression because he had been told in seminary that unless he was successful by the age of 40, he's a failure. He's a failure. And then he described how every promise this church had made him had been broken. He'd taken, you know, they promised him that he could create a Christian high school as part of the, they had a lot of buildings and stuff, and he had this dream of a Christian academic institution, a high school. And no sooner had he started it than the people who were supporting it pulled the plug on it. One thing after another. Until finally he's in this deep depression. 40th birthday, 1 month away. And everything has failed. And his wife had said, don't come home unless you get some help. And he looked me straight in the eye and he said these words. He said, I'm ready to go and take my life. This isn't, it's not worth living. So I said to him, okay, we'll work together. Invited his wife to come in. We started for them each separately and together for a while. And today, one of the things I did with them is that I enrolled them both in our Doctor of Ministry program, both of them. And today, Jim and Molly Scott will tell you, because they're very open about this story. Both have their Doctor of Ministry now. Both realize that they weren't called to pastoral ministry. She went on to become a vice president for World Vision in the United States, and then later became vice president for Word Publishing, the publishers who published my books. He went on to become president of the Living Bible organization. He's moved on since then, and so has she. But it totally revolutionized their life. And all because of this irrational belief that you've got to be successful by your 40, by the time you're 40. Where does the Bible say that? I only know one principle in the Bible about success, and that's that thing called faithfulness. Be ye faithful. Well done, thou good and faithful servant. There's no special accolade for anyone who is successful by 40. Not at all. Then the sixth point I'm going to say is simply get help. If you can't stop the slide, get help. Burnout is not something you can do for yourself otherwise. On the chronic burnout, I want to say something of that and then close with point F, the preventing burnout. From burnout, chronic burnout is not much different, but I would add the following to chronic burnout. You've got to review physical factors very often. Some physical factors are contributing to chronic burnout. Insufficient rest. I believe a lot of you had conversations about sleep last night. That's good. I hope the Holy Spirit is really, really working and convicting and all that. But insufficient rest, insufficient sleep will contribute. Fatigue, illness, immune system problems, and so forth. Review the physical factors. Go and have a physical. Well, I've done a bit of work in the States for Seventh-day Adventists. And they are undergoing in the United States a dramatic revolution in their theology. It's just phenomenal what God is doing in that denomination. And in another significant one there as well, but particularly in Seventh-day Adventists. But when you do a conference for Seventh-day Adventists, you have the big group of people, the first day of the conference, the first morning, they have a team of doctors there. And every participant in the conference has a physical exam. That's how seriously they take health. That's right. It's phenomenal. But you see, and Underlying that is a theology of the temple. The body is the temple of the Holy Spirit. You don't have a mandate to abuse the body. You do not have a mandate to abuse the body. And a high respect. It's a high view of creation that drives that. And often burnout, what you need is a good physical. Review the psychological factors. Maybe your personality. Maybe you've got some hidden addictions going there. That adrenaline addiction could be a factor. Irrational expectations, depression, I think it's obvious what I'm talking about there. And then review spiritual factors, theological anemia. You will not survive if your theology is not being renewed. And then I'd say also that sometimes it's for chronic burnout, you really need to set up a spiritual director of some sort. That's something taking on in the States now. A lot of clergy establish a spiritual director relationship. Because when it comes down to the wire, when you think about it for a moment, so who ministers to the minister? You've got to be self-nurturing, but that's a little incestuous, isn't it? If you're wise, you give your pulpit to someone else in the congregation or one of your associates once a quarter or even once a month. And you go and worship somewhere else. In our Baptist church in South Africa, once a month regularly, a fellow by the name of Calvin Cook, who was a Presbyterian minister, wonderful, thoroughly evangelical pastor, sitting in the back with his wife and family in our Baptist church. He'd come to our Baptist church from a Presbyterian church for his own renewing. How many Baptist pastors went to his church? Not many. It's one of the world's really outstanding preachers is Calvin Cook, now retired in South Africa. But preventing burnout, just closing, there are three theologies, and then I'm going to say something about a support system. Three theologies. The first thing you've got to do to prevent burnout is you really have to develop a healthy theology of compassion. Most of us, untrained in this area, tend to believe that we help people by hurting with them. We call it sympathy. So a lot of pastors are driven by sympathetic responding to people. When we sit with somebody who is bereaved and going through intense pain, we go away and we also feel the pain of that. And then we say, well, you know, we're called to weep with those that weep, are we not? Sympathy tries to help people by hurting with them, by showing that you hurt with them. It's a very common way of relating to people. But you need to know this, that there's nothing more disgusting, in my opinion, than somebody who tries to help me through sympathy. When we were right in the middle of our bereavement of Richard's death, I had scores of Christian people come to me and say things like, oh, I know how you're hurting, because you know I had a brother who died, so I know exactly how you're hurting. And I want to look at them, I want to scream at them and say, what has that got to do with my hurt? Do you think it makes me feel better if my hurt is making you hurt? And so we need to straighten out our theology of compassion. Our theology of compassion must be more empathically based than sympathetically based. Sympathy says, you see, I know how you're hurting because I'm hurting with you. Empathy says, I can never know what you're feeling. Even if I had the exact same experience, I can never know it. But I want to understand it. So empathy is able to step back and say, I'm here to understand what you're feeling, but I cannot feel the same hurt you feel. A faulty theology of compassion, I love that we sang the song, you know, Jesus, keep me near the cross. The wonderful words, but it doesn't say, Jesus, keep me on the cross. Says, keep me near the cross. There a precious fountain. You see, Jesus and only Jesus suffered for us. When we suffer for people, we are usurping the place of Christ. Can you get that point? You're interfering. You're getting in the way. Christ suffered. Christ bore our pain. Pastor, get out of the way. You cannot bear that pain yourself. All you can give is understanding. And I can go home at the end of the day, listening, having listened to and try to help people in the most horrible of life circumstances. And during the day I would have cried many times with them. But they are tears of understanding. They are not tears of substitution. They are tears of profound empathy. They are not tears of sympathy. Sympathy will burn you out. Because if you have to bear the pain of everybody you try to help, you don't have the capacity to do that. But we've got to feel bad because we feel guilty if we don't feel bad. So get your theology of compassion right. Get out of the way. Not only will you be more effective in helping people, but you will connect them to the source of real healing more directly. Second thing, get your theology of success straight. I don't have any problems with success. We have such a well-developed theology of success in our evangelical culture that there's not a lot of help we really need, except it's not very healthy. We think of success in terms of numbers, of achieving some goals, and all the rest of it, but I think a theology of success has to be based upon faithfulness, the concept of faithfulness. It's faithful. Be well done, thou good and faithful servant. And there are some people who have no outside evidence of success. They will receive no accolades, no awards, no prizes, no hero worship, who before God one day will be the ones who get the reward. I thank God that years ago I confronted my need to be successful. I have no need whatsoever for any success. Absolutely not. God has just freed me from that. And it freed me from it the day I realized that the only thing God values is faithfulness. Nothing else. Success is a bonus that comes to those who are genuinely faithful. But faithfulness has to be your direction, not. And then develop a healthy theology of failure. I've already thrown out a little bit of one sentences. You know, failure is to grow by. In God's economy, there's no such thing as failure. Only forced growth. Only forced growth. I was speaking at a singles conference once. There was a time when I was very popular in single circles. I was an honorary member of lots of singles groups because I had attended as a speaker so often that I qualified as membership. Kath has just recently joined me as we now will be starting some ministry to singles. And I think that part of our interest now comes out of our own daughter's singleness because of Richard's death. But I was speaking at the singles conference and particularly divorced people feel profound sense of failure. So I was speaking about failure and what to do with it. It's trying to communicate to them, you know, that failure has more to teach us than success. Success does nothing to our character. Failure is a profound schoolmaster. And I use this phrase, you know, that there's no such thing as failure in God's kingdom, only forced growth. And the next morning, this woman who had remarried, was married to a Presbyterian pastor, had gone to work and sat down, and she worked for a large Christian organization, and as she sat down at her desk, there was an envelope on it. She opened it, pulled it out. The letter said, "Dear so-and-so, I'm sorry to inform you, but we have decided to release you." She was being fired. Within the hour, will you please unpack your desk, and a guard will escort you off the premises. No explanation. This is a Christian organization. No explanation. Just so, you're fired. Finished. Go. Pack up and leave within the hour. In a day, she packs her things and she And she leaves the premises. She doesn't wait for the security guard to come. And she just walks out. And she lived about half a mile away, so she was going to just walk home, not call her husband to fetch her or anything, just to get her head together. And as she walked down, she kept saying, "I'm a failure. I'm a failure." And then she says she heard my word ringing in her mind. There is no such thing as failure. Only forced growth. Only forced growth. And she says, by the time I got home, I knew that I had to receive this as from the hand of God. God doesn't cause tragedy, but when tragedy comes, we receive it as from the hand of God. Because at that instant, that tragedy becomes God's will for our lives. Paradoxical. But I know no other way to face the tragedies of life. Excuse me? I'm not talking about sin, no. I'm talking about failure. Thank you for that clarification. There's a failure that is brought on by sin that you have to repent of. But there are lots of things that where we fail, but we're not sinful. You know, for some reason, the person we work for doesn't like us and don't like our work, and so we get fired. Or I don't pass an examination, even though I've studied hard for it. That's what I'm talking about. Failure. Not moral failure, but just ordinary failure. And then lastly, develop an adequate support system. That's part of the self-care that I have hinted at times. A good self-care, and the closing section, I've got some keys to self-care, and you can look through those yourself, because I think they're fairly self-explanatory, but self-care is important to burnout. Lack of self-care can lead to it. Important that one becomes self-caring in order to recover from it. And I want to just pull our whole time together and share a closing thought with you. A closing thought with you from Hebrews chapter 13. I hope we'll pull together everything I said, and then we will make our we'll have lunch together, and then I think make tracks and say our goodbyes. But I want to just share a few words with you from Hebrews chapter 13 as we close. Make it very quick. Hebrews 11 at least, I'm sorry, Hebrews 11. Now faith is being sure of what we hope for and certain of what we do not see. But verse 13 is the phrase, all these people were still living by faith when they died. I think the Authorized Version says they all died in faith, not having received the promise. And who is the writer talking about? He's talking about, go back, you'll see, he's talking about Abel. By faith, Abel offered God a better sacrifice. By faith, Enoch. He's talking about Noah. He's talking about Abraham. All these great saints of the Old Covenant, he's saying every one of them died in faith, not having received the promise. I was speaking to a bunch of, they call themselves young evangelical Presbyterians, a large group of them in retreat. They weren't so young anymore. They'd formed themselves when they were young. Now they're all in their 50s and 60s, and they still call themselves the young evangelical Presbyterians. And it was a wonderful time. There were a couple of hundred of them. And an older Presbyterian minister was there leading the devotion. So he would do the devotional, and I'd come and I was talking about stress and how to be more fruitful in the kingdom, and how to live a longer life, be more efficient, and not burn out. And we came to the last session. He was going to have the last say. And he said, he read this portion and he said, my prayer for you all this last day as we part is that you will all die before you are finished. And I was shocked. I was shocked that you will all die before you're finished. I'm trying to say, don't die prematurely. God intends us to have long and fruitful lives for His kingdom. Don't die before your time. Yet he's saying, my prayer is you all die before you finished. And I was shunned. And then he began to read those words. They all died in faith, not having received the promise. And he began to expound the fact that God is in the unfinished business. In the United States, you can buy furniture, unfinished furniture, and finish it yourself. But he then began to show all the great... God promised Abraham, but he died in faith, not having seen the promise. And I think it's a profound reality for us in ministry. God will finish His work, not you, not me. And that is His design. God finishes His work. You will all die before you finish. So you take the baton for a little while and you carry it. And there comes a time when you take the baton and you hand it to the next runner in the race. It's a relay race, you see. And the next person will take it and will run with it. You will not finish the work. And I say that in closing because I think many of us are driven by a need to finish it all ourselves. And it's in God's order, it's His plan, that we do not finish the work. You're only a part, and a small part at that, in this wonderful plan that God has for His kingdom.